What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. Our Resistance in Residence artist this week is storyteller, theater maker, playwright, and actor Pearl Ong. Good morning, Pearl. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Kat. I'm so happy to be here.
Really happy to have you. Pearl, I want to start with a little bit about you, where and how you grew up. What was your family like?
I grew up in Hong Kong in the 60s, 50s, 60s. And I grew up in very privileged circumstances in Hong Kong. And we moved to this country in 1970. When I was 15, and I've been here ever since. So, what was my family like? I have three siblings, and numerous aunts and uncles and cousins, and I went to a Catholic school in Hong Kong that was run by actually Maryknoll nuns from upstate New York.
Oh wow. I, too, am a survivor of Catholic school, is what I say. I mean, it does. It shapes your worldview in a particular way, right, for those of us who experienced it and made it out. Pearl, what was it like? I mean, you know, we're in a particular set of conditions right now in this country as it pertains to immigrants and the attacks on them by the current administration. What was it like to, at 15? I mean, 15 is a very emotional time, right, where all you want to do is fit in and sort of find some stability. To be uprooted from Hong Kong, brought to the United States, and be an immigrant here at that time?
You know, it was a difficult time because I hadn't expected to leave so early. You know, so that the uprooting was very traumatic, but I adjusted. Fortunately, I already spoke English, so language was not a problem. Academics was not a problem because, you know, the Hong Kong system was really much more rigorous. So that wasn't a problem, but the adjustment to high school in the States was an adjustment. So what was it like? Well, you know, in so many ways, it was traumatic. It was traumatic for all kinds of reasons. Well, first of all, we were no longer so privileged. So that was a shock. But even so, we were okay.
You are a storyteller. You are a writer. When did you discover the world of writing?
Well, you know, I had started taking writing classes probably back in 2010 or so, just as a whim, because I'd gone through a difficult breakup and I thought I want to do something different. So I'd taken, you know, different classes throughout that time, memoir, fiction, comedy, you know, with no particular goal in mind. And then in 2019, I came across David Ford's Creating and Performing Your Own Work class at the Marsh. So I took that, not really having much of an idea of what I wanted to do. I had an idea that I wanted to do stand-up, but I didn't really know how to go about it. And it just morphed into something else, a more personal autobiographical storytelling bits.
What worlds did writing open up for you to explore that perhaps weren't very present for you before then?
Well, because it was autobiographical. So basically, as I like to say, I'm not that creative. So what I drew from was my own experience and my own life. And because of that, it became more personal than I had intended. So that's why, so what it opened up to me was in delving into that, I remembered stuff that I had forgotten about family dynamics or childhood or specific incidents, that sort of thing. So that was really interesting.
Can you talk a little bit about your process?
Most of this, the piece that I'm doing now is an hour long, and it was developed over several years in different classes with David Ford. I would take a class, sometimes I would take a class, one class per year, and other times I would take several classes a year, take a break, and then go back. So the process was, it's autobiographical, so I did it in chronological order. So the process is that I would come in with a piece that I'd written, mainly almost in a journalistic way, journalistic meaning it was my personal journal. And then David Ford would ask questions, other people in the class would ask questions. And next time I would come back, either fleshing out the piece to answer the questions they had, or I would change it altogether and go into a different direction. And eventually he would say, freeze it, and then we work on performance, which for me the first time was a shock because I said, well, I don't know, this is prose. And he would say, well, you can liven up doing this. How does your mother stand? How would you play this character? Maybe they have these particular quirks or something like that, so that, I could actually act it out on stage, because most of my stuff has other characters in it. And it was kind of a shock because I didn't even like public speaking, and the performance part of it, I wasn't exactly ready for. But I did it because I thought, well, it's part of the class. I paid for the class. I'm going to do it. You know, I'm not going to kind of like bug out before this happens. So yeah, that's how it started.
Because it's so personal, to have somebody direct you through that piece and also the upheaval of emotional stuff that was slightly buried, can you talk a little bit about your relationship and trust between you and your director, David Ford?
Definitely. Yeah. David Ford is really, he is really, really good. So he never pushes you in a direction that you don't want to go to. He just asks questions and makes suggestions about how to perhaps liven up what you want to talk about. He doesn't really give you ideas or insist on that you talk about one thing or another thing that you don't want to talk about. Part of what I wanted to do was really comedy. So I, even though the piece is not completely funny, I do pick out stories that are funny because I enjoy making people laugh.
July is Mental Health Awareness Month, and The Marsh is running several pieces. Your piece is called Night Driver. Give the audience a bit of a synopsis about what the show is about.
So the show is about me growing up in Hong Kong. A lot of it is about my mother. It's a sort of a spotlight on my mother as well. And then being uprooted and taken to this country, and then making my way for all of us, actually, for me and my mother, to start a new life in this country. So it's autobiographical from when I was a kid to probably when I was 30 or something like that, 30 something. And it's a journey. In the interim, I came out, I drove a cab in San Francisco for quite a bit of time. And I drove it at night. So hence the title of the piece, Night Driver. So there are a lot of the stories interspersed with cab stories.
That I can only imagine driving a cab at night in San Francisco, what kind of stories you come up with. I would love you to tug on some threads without revealing too much, that the piece is part of a series that the Marsh is doing to acknowledge Mental Health Awareness Month. What are the threads about mental health that are in your piece?
I think probably what I do talk about is that one of my fellow drivers that I met was a woman that had run away from home because she was gay and had tried to kill herself because she felt so ostracized. So that's part of it. And the other part of it is, too, that at that time in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, San Francisco was a destination for gay people from all over the world. And the way that works, of course, back then was that we had no way of knowing who was gay and who wasn't unless we went to the gay club and we saw somebody and we saw, oh, they're gay. So, and you also then knew who you might hit on, and you know, because you can't do that willy-nilly outside of that milieu. So because it was all centered around the bars, then there was a lot of drinking. There was a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs. So it's a spotlight on that as well.
I talk a lot in my other job, and with my other hat, about trauma, right? And that if we're ever going to live in a society that's actually safe, we have to address people's trauma. And because we push down the trauma, right, just to function inside of society, to drive a cab or get a cup of coffee or raise our kids, go to work, whatever, right? If we actually sat in all of the trauma that we walk with, particularly as folks of color in this country, it would be very hard to function. And one of the ways in which some folks deal with that trauma is to try to drown it with drugs and alcohol. And I'm just wondering if you can tug on that thread just a little bit more, because that too is something that's stigmatized in this country, right? Folks that are figuring out how to deal with their trauma by numbing it, which is a pretty natural, normal reaction.
I think that, you kind of just summarized it, right? If you're dealing with trauma, if you're ostracized, then you want to escape. And the easiest way to escape is either to drink or do drugs or just get high or however you want to do that. And in a way, even for people, I went to high school here in the 70s, and it seemed to me that even for people who weren't particularly traumatized, drugs were just everywhere. It was just a thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Marijuana was very, very, very prevalent. And the high school I went to, which was in Los Angeles, there were just a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
People came to school on acid, you know, just for fun, you know. And I was offered drugs all the time and freely offered drugs. It was just like, well, do you want this? Got some of that? You know, that sort of thing.
Pearl Ong, we are living in a very particular political time where we've got an administration that is attacking both immigrants and the LGBTQIA+ community in some pretty vicious ways. And I'm wondering your thoughts about the role of art and artists in this time to push back.
I think that people can push back in the ways that they feel are most effective for them. I think that in a way, what I do is I talk about the effects of either this, what any kind of discrimination on a personal level for the people who are affected, myself as well as other people that I came into contact with. And I think in a way that is the most effective because it is anecdotal and it is personally experienced. And I think that is I think that's a pretty effective way to do it. Because on a personal level, perhaps I'm being naive, but on a personal level, I think person to person, people are more persuadable because they see this person in front of them and they're telling you their story. And, you know, one would hope that they get it, that they're not just looking at you as whatever label they put on you. And they see a person who is experiencing either trauma or grief or sadness or you know, discrimination on a very, very personal level. So I think that to me is an effective way of going about it.
Yeah, I've said often that, right, so I'm an organizer in my other life, and so sometimes I'm on a street corner screaming, you know, and not everybody can come hear that. But if I can get you in a 99-seat black box theater, that opens up avenues to have different conversations. When people let their guards down in the theater when the lights go down, right? They're more receptive to messages that perhaps when they're walking around the world with their armor on can't seep through as well. Mental health, Pearl Ong, is such a stigmatized issue, but it's also a racialized issue. And I talk about that a lot on this show. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, thank you, Kimberly Crenshaw, for intersectionality and the analysis there. The realities, right, of being Asian, that intersecting with mental health realities, intersecting with the realities of being queer in this world. I mean, there's general society racism, but there's also medical industrial complex racism, there's stigmatization, there's criminalization, and all of that stuff impacts folks of color as we move through the world.
One thing I've noticed is that when I talk to my Chinese American friends who have grown up here, their experience has been very, very different from mine. I didn't get here till I was well into my teens, and I grew up in a majority culture. So I did not suffer the slings and arrows that a lot of people who are, you know, people of color who grew up here suffered through their formative years. And also, I think I've sort of protected myself because I've moved to San Francisco, and it's a very tolerant place. People are from everywhere, and people are very aware, for the most part, of how they behave and how they ought to behave toward other people. So I've been lucky in that sense. And also, I have to say that, because I came from a privileged background, and because even though we did come to this country because basically my father suffered a huge financial setback, but even so, we were still, you know, middle class. And so I haven't been subject to the discrimination and the lack of healthcare and, you know, all the things that in this country money ameliorates. My friend Connie and other friends of mine have definitely suffered greatly because they haven't had access to healthcare or you know, all kinds of other privileges. It's very upsetting. It's very, very upsetting.
Pearl, I'm going to ask you, it might feel like a similar question. I'm going to ask it a little bit different way. Can you talk about the theater as a place of refuge and healing?
Arts in general, and theater in, particularly, is... I have people come up to me after my show sometimes, and they will say to me, I was there. I remember that. I remember feeling that way. And in some cases, it's, I think, somewhat cathartic. And in some cases, it brings it back to them. And I think it's healing to hear other people's stories. And, you know, my thing is, I say that everybody has a story. You know, nobody's story is really standard. If I can do it, you can do it. And all the stories are interesting. And we can learn from all the stories, what people go through, how they get through it, changes they go through in life and their families, and hearing about it from other people, somehow, sometimes for some people, minimizes the shame they felt at one time in their life. And they think, oh, I see, I'm not the only one. And it makes it better.
I agree, it does make it better. Pearl Ong, is there anything about your craft, this piece, your journey that I haven't asked you that you would like listeners to know?
It is storytelling. Sometimes people describe it as stand-up, and I say, no, it's not all funny, you know, because I don't want people to sit there and think, oh my God, this is not what I signed up for. But it is funny. It is interesting. It is a different... The trajectory of my life, I think, is a little bit unusual. Having moved here at a young age and then going through the 70s and the 80s in San Francisco at a very particular point in time. Well, when I started driving a cab, there were very few women driving cabs. I've been told more than once that I'm the first Asian woman to have driven a cab in San Francisco, and also at night. I really enjoyed doing that. I really actually loved the job. You know, in the 70s, it was everybody, I mean, feminism was just coming into its own. And it was very important to me that I not be kind of drummed out of a job that I loved because of fear or whatever it was.
Pearl Ong, for folks that want to check you out and check out Night Driver, when and where is it playing, and where can people get more information?
Yes, it is playing every Saturday at 5 p.m. at the Marsh in San Francisco at 1062 Valencia Street between 21st and 22nd, easily accessible by BART. And it will start a week from Saturday on July 19th and runs till August 23rd, once a week on Saturdays for 6 Saturdays in a row at 5 p.m. And they can get tickets at themarsh.org.
All right. We will have that information in the archive version of the show. Family, you've been listening to Resistance in Residence, where we feature artists using their talents to change the world. Our guest this week is storyteller, theater maker, playwright, and actor Pearl Ong, whose piece, Night Driver, is at the Marsh Theater, July 19th through August 23rd. Pearl Ong, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kat.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.